This is Keith Gainey, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 21st of June 2013.
It's Keith John Gainey, South Elmsall.
Where's that?
It's South Elmsall in the West Riding of Yorkshire, which was South Yorkshire. It's between Barnsley, Doncaster and Wakefield.
And what's your date of birth?
5/2/44.
So you're now
69.
Every field has to think about that for a minute, because they still think themselves as being young men.
I think I've got a theory, and it's since we're coming here, when did I start coming in? Because I worked overseas for a long, long time, and I come back about 7 or 8 years ago. I started to bring my wife. And she was amazed at how fit the older fellows were. Some they're older than me, because I'm probably a younger one. And I said, well, it's easy. We were immune from bugs. And I believe that 2 years you spend has made you look healthier and fitter. And so we still walk around 80-odd-year-olds, and those are with 60s. And I think it's true when you see everybody. They don't look their age.
No, they don't.
And I think it's because of that environment.
The other thing they were immune from...
Theory.
The other thing they were immune from 2 years, of course, was women, wasn't it?
Yes. Apart from talking on the... You get messages through the... Yes.
Perhaps best not to mention that to the wife, though.
No, she wasn't married. I wasn't married then.
Yeah.
There was only one married person there on the 2 years, I think. I was there. That was Pop, the Ironless Ferries for the second year.
Did it make a difference, do you think?
No. Yeah. I don't think we ever thought about it, to tell you the truth.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
No.
What was he?
A miner, coal miner.
Oh, right.
So he was the eldest of eight.
By rights, then you should have followed him into the pit, shouldn't you?
I weren't allowed.
Why not?
Dad didn't want it. The village we're in, South Elmsall and South Kirby, we're in the middle of the mining villages. I was the oldest of eight. I started the grammar school and I started my A-levels on physics and maths. And by that time, the four eldest were at the grammar school and we struggled. And my dad said, you don't want to go down the pit. So the alternative was the services. That was the only in them days, 60s, you either went in the army or you went down the pit in our villages, where I elected for the Air Force.
Why?
I didn't want the army. I elected actually elected the Navy first for a scholarship, because I'd gone to the headmaster and said I wanted to leave, which he didn't want to. He thought I should have gone to university. And I said, I'm leaving. I said, because it's necessary. And I applied for the Navy, and it came back. I couldn't get a scholarship for the Navy because I wore glasses, so I couldn't be an officer in those days. So I then applied for an apprenticeship to the Air Force, of which I did an apprenticeship in radio. But I was one of the last 15 that was double trade, which is we did radar and communications. And that's why we went to the BAS. Because BAS asked the Air Force for air radio fitters to do the meteorology side, because we were two trades and you needed it. And they couldn't get the Met men to go. So the one before me was Air Force. I was Air Force. The one after me was Air Force.
So you were a secondment, were you?
Yes.
And taking with you the two trades, one of radar...
And communications.
And telecommunications, yeah.
Because you needed it with the radar...
For the sonar.
For the wind finder.
Yeah.
But you needed it for the the rest of the stuff in the Met Office, which was the radios, and the Sintel, which was the valve computer. And we had the instrumentation, the Met Office instruments.
T- Tell me about this Valve computer. What was it called?
Oh, the Rank Centel. We had to go on a course to the Met Office in Bracknell, didn't it? Yeah,
what did he do?
He just took the signals from the radio sound and converted them onto the graph. So to the radio signals, took the radio signals out of it, put it through the Valve system, converted it into digital, you see, and then put it onto graphs. But it was like, your wardrobe there is a third of the size. It was two of them. If one failed, you got a backup, as we're talking now. But it was the width of them was about three times your wardrobe was that with the size of it was.
And you took this to the Antarctic?
It was there when I went. Bass had got it down then. Halley 1 had the ranks at the Centel in. And we transferred it to Halley 2.
That must have been some job.
We got it in a day, and we didn't lose a balloon flight. We shifted it out of Halley 1, up the shafts, got it on the sledges, up to Halley 2, into Halley 2 Met Office, and I got it working for the next day's Met Office balloon flight.
That's quite an achievement, isn't it?
I thought it was quite good. We really worked well, the lads. There's only four of us, the Met men.
Yeah.
And the other one is Wolf 2.
Right, I've seen reference to that, but tell me about Wolf 2.
Well, Wolf 1 was grey and it was knocking on a bit. But Wolf 2 was brought down on the Perler and it was white and it had air conditioning. And because it had been bought from Singapore.
Yeah.
And it was white and blue from with the air conditioning. So I took the air conditioning off.
And what do the Wolves do?
Tracks the balloon. It's a radar system, tracks the balloon.
So it's a more modern version of the one you talked about earlier?
No, Rank Centel is... The Centel is radio.
Right.
The Wolf Windfinder is radar. It's got a radar dish and sends radar beams out. When the balloon goes up, it had a trefoil, aluminium trefoil on the bottom, which reflected the radar beams, and that's how you tracked it. So you tracked that on your radar and you took measurements of the elevation and the degrees every minute with a Met man sat next to you. Then you went in and you plotted that along with the information. So every time we had a balloon flight, they had to sit and plot the route that it went and how it went.
And do these two machines talk to each other?
No. No, they're completely separate. Completely separate. The Centel only spoke to the wireless communication because the radio sound had a little wireless battery-operated thing and it transmitted back the humidity, the pressure, the temperature as it went up.
Yeah.
That was modulated radio frequency, like we talk on the radio.
Hmm.
That was picked up by a normal radio, shortwave radio.
Right.
So we had an aerials outside picking that one up. So that transmit, and then in addition to that, we had the trefoil aluminium, which reflected the radar. So you got two separate systems. And from the two, they used both information to plot the balloon.
So the radar system was telling you where the balloon was, and the radio was picking up the signals.
Telling you the pressure, temperature, humidity.
Of the conditions around the balloon at the time.
Yes.
Pretty high tech for 1967, isn't it? In the Antarctic?
I was surprised. Well, working on the military side, of course, it was low-tech to us, right? Mm. But to have it actually in the Antarctic was probably quite good to get it down there. It was, low-tech to us.
And was it dependent upon 24-hour power?
Yes. So electric power, the generators.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Let's go back anyway now.
All right.
You're in the RAF.
Yeah.
And somehow you get seconded to the Antarctic, British
well,
Antarctic
Service. What happened to the Air Force is when I did my apprenticeship, the first year, every summer they send a memorandum through to all stations saying, would anybody like to volunteer? But it has to be an air radio fitter, which are limited. And I, in 64, just after the year I'd left my apprenticeship, the first year I was on the V-bombers working, it came out, and I applied then. Don't know what's me why you want to go, but I applied then. And I was turned down.
Because?
Because obviously somebody else must have got it.
Right.
Then in 66, it came up again, and I was at Linton-on-Ouse, in which case the Air Force selected me to go for an interview to Bass to see Mr. Slocum.
Sloman.
Yeah. Mr. Sloman, yep.
So again, it was your choice. You weren't sent. You had chosen.
No, it's my choice.
Yeah. Why were you choosing then? Why were you wanting to go to the Antarctic?
Don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I think it's in your blood if you want to travel.
Right.
And if it's in your blood, you want to travel to places that other people don't. One of my mother's uncle was in the Merchant Navy, travel around the world. And I always wanted to travel, and ever since I have. Because since I've left the Antarctic, I've walked most of the Libyan desert, I've worked in all the Omani deserts, and I've been around all these places, because it's what you want to do. And well, you can't put a definitive answer to it. It's something that you feel you want to do.
The thing in common is deserts, isn't it? Because the Antarctic is a desert too.
But again, there wasn't the choice of the desert. It was a choice of going to work or I wanted to go. Yeah. It just so happens that they were the places in 74, 78, where the oil was, that that's where it is.
Had you learned a lot about the Antarctic?
No.
You seen Scott of the Antarctic? You read about Shackleton?
No, not before I went.
All right. So it really was a leap in the dark?
Yep.
What did your mum and dad think of it?
They were quite proud. My dad was. I know my dad was really proud that I'd actually taken a leap to actually go to something like this. And it was because it gets in the local paper.
Yes. Howard Keith.
Yeah. And, my dad was quite proud. I think my mum was as well. And I think the family still have ever since been quite pleased that I've done it. All eight, it's other seven brothers and sisters.
Tell me about the interview. What do you recall?
Very little, really.
Do you think it was a foregone conclusion?
Yeah. In retrospect, yes. I do. I think I was the only one that went. From the Air Force. I can't think for the other people, right? But only from my particular point, I think I was probably the only one from the Air Force that was actually sent. There were very few air radio fitters around. So it's not like you've got thousands to choose from. And then from all of those, you've got the ones that wanted to volunteer. And it might be then that year I may be the only volunteer.
And you were interviewed by Bill Sloman?
Yep. And there was somebody else. A younger bloke.
Johnny Green?
He came down on the Perla in 69 and then came back. He came to see the base Halley 2 finished.
I forgot
his name.
Yeah. So you were going to be on your RAF pay?
Yes.
Which was more than the...
No.
No?
No. Because I paid tax. I paid tax. Everything. Still in the services. In fact, I got an extra allowance for going to the Antarctic.
What, to buy woolly socks?
To buy woolly socks. I don't know what it was for, really, because there were certain things in the Air Force. I could talk about it now. But it's like if you go on embassy duties, MPs that go on embassy duties, they are special assignments. You get a special allowance. Right, and you're administrated from one place, which used to be Uxbridge. Right, so for 2.5 years, I was told I would get this much extra money. And after about 6 months, I think my father said something in one of the letters we get. Right? No money had gone into my bank. So I sent a telex off to the Air Force to ask why, and they'd sent it in. And then when I got home, they'd only paid me my basic. So I had to go into the accounts and say, this is what I'd been told, and this is what I'm entitled to. And so I got it all back at the end.
Did they kind of prepare you for being in the Antarctic? Was there any training, any special training, any survival training or crevasse rescue training?
No. The only training we had was going to Cambridge and having Sir Vivian and Raymond Priestley give us a talk and show us slideshows. And that was it. I was impressed with Priestley.
Tell me about him.
I was really, he got a brilliant slideshow. And I've read all about him since because I bought books all about it. And I was impressed with what he did when they stayed and survived that that winter while Scott was away. And they'd still got summer clothing. I thought he'd done probably a better job than Scott.
Mm. Had he still got it when you saw him?
Still got what?
The charisma, the presence.
Yeah, it's quite a tall... Well, everybody's tall to me. He's quite a tallish guy, and he was very calm talking. I remember that. He sat with a few of us in Cambridge and just talked about it. Yeah, I was quite impressed with him. Whereas Vivian, of course, Vivian was more the outgoing type. And he got Priestley was like, I've done it anyway, and probably, and he was knocking on a bit as well, and just more relaxed. But Vivian Fuchs was really trying to push the Antarctic, and it was good. I thought Cambridge was good. I don't know if they still do that.
They do
an induction course.
It's much more extensive now.
Is it?
And there's a section in Derbyshire where you throw yourself off rocky cliff faces to.
Oh, is it?
Fight your way back up again.
Oh, we didn't. We had nothing. Nothing.
So when you got there, did you feel unprepared? Or did you get training when you got there?
I don't know. Well, felt then, Chris. I suppose going down on the boat with the other guys, you got to be... Then we did the Falkland Islands, where we loaded and offloaded and got our gear. When we got the gear, but then it's just like in the services where you get your uniforms. Mm. So that didn't make any difference. And then we went to Deception, Cygni, Deception, down to Anvers. So we went twice into Grahamland on the Biscoe. We had Christmas in Potter's Cove with the Shackleton. So you were getting the feel of the Antarctic before I got to Halley.
Yeah.
Because of the trips on the Biscoe going down the peninsula. So by the time we got to Halley, I'd already got some idea of the environment, say, and the clothes we had to wear, because we were wearing our sweaters. So I'd already got used to the clothes. So I didn't... I wasn't surprised at anything when I got to Halley.
Mm. I was interested that you spent Christmas in Potter's Cove with HMS Shackleton. Was it?
Yeah.
Sheer chance?
No, it was arranged.
All right. So you had dinner on the Shackleton, did you?
No, we had dinner on the Biscoe. They came across to the Biscoe, the Shack crew. I got dressed up as a chef and helped to serve the dinner. I've got slides to in my uniform. Yeah, we had Potter's Cove with the Shackleton. That was 66 Christmas.
On your way down, yeah.
Yeah.
What did they make of the Falklands in the 60s?
Nice people. We played football against them. We played cricket with them. But apart from that, the only time you mixed with them was probably at the bar, which was at 10, and then you were back on the boat. Mm. I don't remember any. I can't tell you of any of the names.
Did you meet the governor?
No, I didn't.
You never got sent to?
No.
Government House?
We took his taxi down that we bent.
You bent it?
Yeah, it was lifted off on the, with the string nets.
Yeah.
We lifted it off with that, so it actually come round and it bent a bit of the taxi for him.
Were you unloading it or...?
Unloading it.
Was this a new one?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what happened to him. That's, they unloaded that from the Bisco and gave it to him. Mm. I never met him. Never.
Right.
And I can't even tell you the results of our cricket match and football match with him.
Probably irrelevant.
And now I was wicket keeper and then goalkeeper, that's all.
Right. So when you got to Halley, I think even then was quite different in feel to the West Coast.
Oh, completely different.
Places. So, I mean, for a start, did you know you were going to be living underground? Or was that a bit of a surprise?
Yeah, I think that was a surprise. But it didn't worry me. It didn't worry me. We had Halley 2 crew were down, the building crew. So the offloading was hectic. Because I was trying to learn the wet radar, taking on from Brian Swift. And after that was finished, the balloon flight, we were helping the guys on Halley 2 offload and building. So we had to travel up and down.
So you brought building materials down with you on the Perla down?
Yes, we did. Because we transferred from the Bisco to the Perla at... I can't remember if I did it in South Georgia or whether it wasn't... Because they both went down.
Mm.
Whether we did it in South Georgia or in the Falklands.
Don't worry.
I think, because I remember when we went to the South Georgia, we killed a load of elephant seals to take down to Halley.
Tell me about Halley 1. Was that the old IGY hut?
Right. Yes. The old IGY hut was 60 foot down. Brian Swift before me lived in that because the middle hut was being used, but there was no roof on it. It was badly built. So when I took over from Brian, I still lived in the IGY hut, and my bench was also my bed, which is also my workshop. And we had to climb up the Dexian ladder, and then we got to the second hut, which was 62, I think, which is one that I didn't have enough space, so there was no roof. And then we climbed up again to the third hut, which is a 66 one or something, the 64 one.
And then up to the service from there.
When we were building Halley 2, the people used to come from Halley 2, the builders, on a Saturday night, they would come down to Halley 1. And we would have the Saturday dinner at Halley 1, in the middle hut. Until one day, the snow came down all over the Arga, the cooker. We couldn't cook. And Ricky Chin said, we'd better start having it at Halley 2. So after that, we travelled up to Halley 2. Mm. But Halley 1 middle hut started to get really bad. So everybody that lived there, the scientists then moved into 64 hut, and then I had to shift in from the bottom one as well to 64. We lived in the attic, right, for just about 6 or 7 months in the attic of the 64 hut before we moved to Halley 2.
It must have been weird to be living, working, eating and sleeping 60 foot below the surface.
It was weird, but... It's hard to say how you feel. I never felt...
Claustrophobic?
No, or there was something I shouldn't be doing.
Mm.
I just felt it was part of the job. This is how it is. And we just get on with it. And this Halley 2 is going to be built. So you're going to move when this is finished. And you make the best of it.
You reckon you're the last man to stay?
Yep.
You're the last man to sleep down there? By choice or chance?
Because that was by chance, because Brian Swift, the radar man before me, stayed there. Mm. So when I took over, that was my bed. So I stayed there. That was just handover. Right.
Meanwhile, they were building Halley 2 on the surface.
Yes.
How was progress on that? Was it going well?
That went really well. We went up most after the balloon flight. If we had no problems, then we went up and helped out.
Yeah.
I think they built Halley 2, yeah, just as a general dog's body. And that went all right, actually. They got the huts up quite well. Enough so they get them into shelter. And, they were sleeping in them before the winter. Because we had our midwinter up there. 66 midwinter was up in Halley 2. And we travelled up for it from Halley 1.
How far apart were they?
4 miles.
Oh, right.
Roughly, yes.
Inland, further inland?
Yeah. 4 miles further inland. We had a drum line marking it out.
Mm.
We used to use the dogs sometimes, though, training the dogs as well on the skis to go up to it.
So was Halley 2, at that point, the sort of the latest thing in Antarctic bases?
Probably towards, yes. We couldn't think of anything else. I mean, it was supposed to be on rafts, insulated panels, you know.
Was it?
Yeah. It was put on a raft, a wooden raft, massive big wooden beams, cross beams to take the thing, and then steel stanchions or framework, and then prefabricated insulated panels went into it. As far as I'm aware, because I wasn't the builder,
yeah,
only what I can remember, and that's how it was built.
So it was cosier than the old one.
Phew, far cosier. Far cosier than the old one. Yeah, and the big generator sheds as well. Yeah, yeah, it's good.
So when did you turn your back on Halley 1? And
I think it was March 68.
From then on, you were wholly occupied by Halley 2.
By Halley 2, because we transferred, the Met Office transferred up to Halley 2 when we shifted up the Sintel.
Mm.
WF2 was already functional before we did, because the priority was to get WF2 off the boat. And that was functional because I had to get that up running and had to wire that up across to the Jenny shed. Right, we had to.
Were these new skills, or these were skills you brought from the RAF?
Oh, some of them were skills I brought from the Air Force, but then you use the electrician because the high voltage cable than what I was used to, right. More into electronics as opposed to the bigger size cables. Right, so it was Jeff Smith. We called it Jeff Abdul Smith. Mm. We called him Abdul Jeff Smith. He was the electrician. So Jeff helped me pull the cables across, and then we spliced them with a 5-gallon oil burner to solder, because we hadn't got the heat. We had to connect them halfway, so we used a 5-gallon oil burner to solder the two cables together, wrapped it all up in lots of tape, and it worked. Never had no problems with it. So WF2 was... had to be functional before we moved the Met Office.
Hmm.
So WF1 that was then just abandoned. I don't know what happened to it after that. We never used it. It was just left there.
Was it of no value then to be reclaimed?
I have no idea. I suppose I couldn't see anybody ever wanting it.
It would be expensive to bring it back, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, it must have been brought back.
Oh, right. Yes, I suppose he must have done.
It must have been brought back somewhere, scrapped somewhere. Yeah, it must have been.
So was life in the operating the Met balloons, was that much easier from the new base? Or did he have a separate hut anyway for that?
It was a completely new hut. The Halley 2 was completely new, yeah, everything was
new.
Did he
have a Met hut as well, or were you doing it from the main building?
Oh, we had the main building. There was an office block, which was the geophysics and the Met, and we were at the end, which is the tunnels, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, we're at the end hut, and we were at the end of the hut. And the balloon shed was quite a way away, so you still had to go out to the balloon shed, and you still had to go out to the radar. The balloon sheds were not close to the accommodation.
Mm.
Right, and the reason for that is because of the gas.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any difference in actually balloon flights, because you still have to do the same thing.
Mm.
You still have to blow the balloon up and send it off. You still have to track it.
How are you inflating the balloon?
I don't know how they did it. They used caustic soda and to generate the gas. I don't know which gas it was. Finished, it was hydrogen.
More than likely. Certainly one time it was.
Yes.
So your job really was to monitor its progress.
Yes.
And record the signals it was sending back.
Yeah. That was mine.
So even when you built Halley 2, that was still only a part-time job really, wasn't it?
Yes. So you helped out on other factors, other things.
Mm. Did you get into the field at all?
Yep. But go back back to Woof 2. Right. Woof 2 came down in bits and it was at the bottom of the Perla Dam, at the bottom of the hole. It was the last to be offloaded. The reason was we couldn't build it on base. We couldn't lift the radar dish and we could not lift the cabin onto the skis, which was a big geared wheel. We couldn't lift that on base, so it had to be built on the Perla. So it was the last thing to come off. So
it was constructed actually on the Perla.
Yes, we constructed it actually in the hold.
Right.
Okay. The second last came off was the geophysics hut, which is a big fiberglass hut. And then we built Woof 2, and then we brought the Woof 2 off, and lifted it over onto with the skis to haul it along. At that time, we were about 2 miles away from the ice cliffs, the fast ice, and somebody sent down 2 big bridges, sleepers on 2 I-beams, sleepers, which we bridged over the tide crack.
Mm.
Because by the time we were getting, this was getting quite wide. So when we come to the IGY hut, it could not go over the bridge. So we had to put sleepers across and pull the IGY across on 2 long sleepers. But when we got to the Woof, which was the last one, it's on 3 skis. So you need 3. And we were very worried because it's not as wide as the huts. It was only just wider than the actual tide crack.
Right.
So we had Dad Etchells on an International Harvest on one side, and we had Jeff, the big Met men, on the other side, and the harvester. So Dad Etchells was pulling it, and Jeff, I think it was. Anyway, the other guy was letting it out. And halfway across, one of the skis went in. And we nearly lost it. But Dad was pulling, I was shouting at Dad, and Dad must have realised, so he started winching in quickly, and Jeff started letting out quickly, and it just rose up and came and settled through, and we pulled it through. So we nearly lost the Woof too.
That would have been fairly serious, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. But we did lose the bridge.
It went down, did it?
When we come to recover the bridge, I went down with Dad and Johnny Carter to Tractor Mex, and we tried to get the bridge over because you couldn't slide it because it was now the tide crack was nearly as wide as the bridge.
Mm.
And Dad was trying to pull it across on the tractor and it went down. And fortunately, as he kept with the wind slacking on and slacking it, it uncoupled itself out of the shackle and it came back. Otherwise, it had taken the tractor down.
Mm.
But we'd lose the bridge.
Right, that was a close call for Dad, Etchells.
Yes. I thought it was. Definitely, because it was certainly taking the tractor with him.
Okay, let's talk about this. Were you involved also in sort of monitoring the results you were getting from the radar?
Well,
so you
when you did the radar, it's like you help it out on base. Now, there was two of the chefs, right, they get bored. So I taught them to handle the radar. So I could have a day off the radar, but help out cooking. So it was, you took turns. So like once a month, the chef would go down and he'd operate the radar and have a turn one morning, have a lie in bed.
Yeah.
Instead of going out, and then I'd help him out some other time.
So yeah, so you're learning each other's trades.
So you learn a bit of others.
Sorry, I did ask you earlier about whether you got out of the off base quite a lot. Whether you went on any trips.
Yeah, once.
Right.
And that was with Paul Coslett.
This is a glaciological trip.
Yes.
Then. With dogs?
No. We took the Skiddo.
Yeah.
And the Elson. Eliason. Which was a disaster.
Why was that?
Absolute disaster. We went out for 10 days and took 31, I think, 29 or something. I think we took a long time because we went out the same time as the tractors were going to the Tottens. So we went out with them, followed them through the hinge zone up to the top. That was the idea.
Mm.
Well, first of all, it was foggy, and I hadn't been used to the Eliason. I got the Eliason, not the Skidoo. Paul took the Skidoo, which is the modern one. I had the old Eliason, and I fell off it, and Cosy saw it, and he had to unhook his sledge and chase the Eliason. Fortunately, it went in a circle.
Oh, it was running loose, was it?
Yeah, it was running loose. I fell off it. It was still with a running loose with its sledge.
Yeah.
But it went in a circle and came back. So we got hold of it. And it was foggy, so we couldn't see it. It was weird, it was. But when we got to the... before we got to the hinge zone, the tracks of the Eliason broke. So we didn't know what to do across the hinge zone. So Dad said, we'd take it across with the tractors and repair it to the other side. So when we got to the other side, when the tractors left us, me and Cosy made splinters out of the 45-gallon drum with a hammer and chisel, splinters, and holes in a file. And we screwed splinters onto the wooden frames, skids underneath, right? To repair it. And we got it working.
Mm.
So that was one delay before we'd even got to do glaciology. So then we went along for a few days, and one morning we got out and the Eliason engine froze, just ceased. So we didn't know what to do. So we're on skeds with the base talking to the tractor mechanics, which was... Chris Sykes, the base commander. Second year. Chris Sykes, the base commander. To what we're going to do with it. Because all the others were out. Dad was out, Johnny Carter, they were all out. There was no tractors on base that could come. I didn't know what to do, so we sat and stripped it down in the tent. And I remember I needed an Allen key to take the flywheel off. So I manufactured out a 6-inch nail with a file, made an Allen key to get the flywheel off. We got it off, we stripped it, cleaned it all, the sump was full of ice in the oil, put it all back together, it ran beautifully, except we had a tapping noise. And we did not know what the tapping noise was. Nobody on base could tell us what the tapping noise was, so we decided to leave it in case it collapsed again. So Cosy and I went with one skidoo to do the glaciologist. And then we come back and picked it up and decided we'd risk it towards the base. And we drove it right through, down the hinge zone, and then the tracks broke again. So they had to come out with the only tractor and take us back on a sledge. And it turned out there was nothing wrong with the engine. It's because it was so clean, the air breather was tapping. And nobody'd never been cleaned that much before. But that was really good with Cosy.
Tell me about the glaciological work that you witnessed then. What was Cosley doing? Paul Coslett doing?
Mapping, measuring snow accumulation, snow movement, glacial movement, and mapping, that was it. Triangulations, because we had a telerometer, which I handled. So I could repair the telerometer, which is the radar beams.
Yeah.
Okay, between distances, measuring distances. And that's why I got a chance to go on the on the trip, really. So we were using these to triangulate or work out distances whether things had actually moved from points that had already been done beforehand. And Paul was measuring the snow accumulations and movements.
We were actually staking the glacier to see how far it had drifted south.
Or looking for stakes and working out how far they'd shifted from previous locations.
Interesting work?
I loved it. I loved it out on the tents and the beautiful. I thought it was fantastic. I still do. Still got the diary. It's all on my website. Putting it all on the website, the stories, everything.
What's your website called?
Penguinge.
Penguinge?
Yes. PNGWINGE.
Was there any tricky moments on that trip?
There's a couple, actually. It was 24-hour sunlight, so you went to sleep and just got up when you wanted to do. And the sun was low, so we decided to stop, because we'd actually take one sledge, come back, pick another one, move forward, because we only had the one vehicle. The skidoo, it couldn't pull both sledges.
Yeah, so you're relaying.
Right, so relaying all the time. Mm. So by the time we woke up one morning, we're about 5 foot away from a 30-foot crevasse that we hadn't seen because it was bridged.
Right.
And we just walked out of it. And there you could see with the bridge, but you couldn't see it the night before because the way the sun was. Mm. In the morning, there it was. So we'd missed that.
That was a close call,
was it? That was a close call. And then when we were on the sledge, I was on the back of the sledge and Paul was in front on the skid, and I could see one that in front that I thought was a dip. And I was trying to get Paul to stop, and I had to yank the sledge round to slow him down because he couldn't hear me shouting. So when we got off it, I said, I'll go check it. So I guess the bog tittle. And I'm going across on the skis. I'm saying, oh, it's safe, this Paul. This is safe, Paul! As the Paul went straight through. And, it wasn't that thick at the middle. But so we worked out a detour from that area. But we prodded an area which was safer. But that's only two.
How did you get on with him, Paul?
Still do well.
Yeah.
We still talk well. We still just as though we were there. Every AGM, we sit together and have a chat. Chats to my wife.
So these experiences like that field trip with him, then that formed a lifelong bond, did it?
I think it did. Yeah. You still got that bonding when you meet. You still got that with him, as with all the guys on the base, and every base has got that bonding. And you can see it at the AGMs. They get together. My wife, when she'd come, and I'd sat with Dad and Paul and Fanny and Golly, and she said, you know, and she'd never met them before. She says, but I get the impression as though you've never left each other. You just suddenly bonded again.
Yeah.
And chatted away as though you're still friends.
What's the wife's name?
Leslie.
So how is it explaining all this to Leslie? I mean, I think one of the things about having been a FID is that it's a shared experience, which is quite difficult to explain to somebody who hasn't shared that experience. How do you go about...
I wasn't married when I went down, so I didn't get married till I came back. Leslie's my second wife.
So you had to brief her from scratch then, really, quite late on?
Yeah. But when she got to know me, I'd told her I'd been down the Antarctic. Right, and but by the time we'd come to where Les had been, I'd been working overseas. So she knew I'd worked overseas. She knew I'd been to Saudi, Libya, Iran. So it was just part of me when she got to know me. So she just accepted that's where I'd been in my past.
And but do you try to explain to her what it was like to have spent those 2 years in the Antarctic? And do you succeed?
No, we don't bother.
Yeah. Because it's impossible to convey that feeling to a third party?
No, I don't think it comes up. I think it's to Les. I mean, I've always been a guy that's wondered. I've been on my own in the deserts, and it's just, it might be different if it's like the only thing I'd done, I suppose.
Mm.
And she'd known me from the beginning, but she'd known that I'd travelled along and worked overseas a lot before I met her. So it was just part of it.
John Brotherhood, the doctor, was...
was in
Halley at the time you were there. I think you were around at the time of his accident.
Yes.
He's here this weekend.
Yeah, no, I know.
Have you met him already?
No, I haven't seen him, but I met him last 2 years ago. Yeah.
What do you remember of that period?
John went with Jim Shercliffe on a manhauling expedition, right? And we got a whiteout and we didn't hear of them for a day or two. And the next thing I know is they'd found John and Jim. It was found that, but Doc John was hurt.
Hmm.
Right. And I got, the information I got is that he went to high level, which was Harold Wilson and the American president, to fly a Hercules across from New Zealand, refuel at the South Pole, pick John up and take him to New Zealand, right, for Kazavak, as we call it, right? And that's what they did. But it was a bit funny because when we knew they were coming, nothing had ever landed there.
At Halley, there'd been no plane ever.
Never. So we had to, where would they fly over? They didn't know. So I think it was Dad that got the idea. First we put a row of black oil drums to mark a runway, and I think it might have been Abdul, Jeff Smith, who come with the idea, used cocoa. So at the beginning of the runway, we put a great big cocoa arrow, massive. We used all the cocoa we got because nobody drank cocoa. So when they came over from the air, they saw this big cocoa
black arrow,
and then when they landed, they could see the lines, right? And then when the guys got off, it was the same time deception erupted.
Yes.
And some of the newspaper reporters on the Hercules or the Yanks thought they were at Deception Island. So we said, no, we're not. Deception's way over there.
So they were looking for a volcano?
A volcano. But they were there because they were actually evacuating John Bro.
Mm.
And then they took him on board and just took off. They struggled to take off.
Tell me about that.
Right. They had to put jet-assisted bottles on it, right, because they're on skis and, there's no grip. Right, and it took a long time before they got off the ground with these four on either side. It took a long time to get off. Then the funny thing was a few days later they came and dropped all the cocoa back to us. And nobody wanted it, so they dropped a load of cocoa back.
In the period between John Brotherhood being found and the aeroplane arriving, was there a period that, what was the feeling like on the base? Were you very concerned about what was going to happen?
I think we were all worried about John. You know, whether he was all right. Because nobody knew whether he'd get out or not. we were definitely worried about him.
But you must have been, at some point, you must have been told, don't worry, the Americans are coming.
Yes, but it was quite quick. It's like they're coming now.
Oh, right.
It wasn't like in a week's time.
Yeah.
They were it's like they're, on, like they're on the way.
Yeah.
Right, and that's what we were told. And, of course, even then, you think, well, nobody's ever been before. How are they going to find us?
How did they find us?
How did they find us? But well, they did. But they did admit that said if it wasn't for the cocoa and the things, they were looking at just a white expanse. It did show where it was. But that was Dad and Jeff Abdul Smith. I think Jeff was the instigator of the Coco. Yeah, it's good that. That was. Yeah, it's funny that, because they got off and wanted to know where Deception was. What did we do with John Brough?
Well, you kept him fairly heavily drugged, I seem to recall.
Yeah. I don't know who looked after him whilst he was waiting. I don't know who looked after him whilst he was waiting. I was trying to think what experiments Doc John was doing. We did three experiments on site with the physios and the docs did.
Were you helping?
All of them.
You were a guinea pig for all three?
Yeah.
Did you have a choice?
Yeah, we were asked, and I said yes. What did John do? Was it John did the... I think John did the fatness test. John did the fatness test. That was the first year. Second year we had Doc Murray and John Fry. The second year we ate 3 months diabetic food for Doc Murray, and we did the teeth for John Fry. With John, we couldn't clean teeth for 3 days, and John then sprayed and took photographs to see how much, well, I don't know what, sugars were accumulated on your teeth and things. But with Doc Murray, we ate the diabetic food to see what effect it had on our bodies. And the beauty of that is I get a sugar tie. When we come back, the MRC give all of us a sugar tie. It's a tie with a sugar molecule on in gold braid. And I've still got that. Yes. It's a sugar tie. It's a
tie. Medical Research Council tie.
Yes. Yeah. But it doesn't say that. It's just got the sugar molecule on.
All right.
So I call it a sugar tie. And I mentioned it to Doc Murray last year, whether he still got his. He said he's still got his. What I'm going to do in the newsletter is to find out if everybody's still got it, because there could only be about 16. Because only 15 of us on it. Oh, funny story with that one.
Go on.
When I left the Air Force, I applied for a job in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for communications at an island off the Gulf of Oman, which is a ground radio installation. And I don't like wearing ties. And it's foreign, and I said to my wife, the first wife, I'm going down for this interview, I'm going to put the suit on, I'm going to put my sugar tie on. She said, what for? I said, because I'm going to be interviewed by the Foreign Office people, civil servants, and they're into schools.
Right.
Old school boy.
Old school ties, yeah.
See? She said, well, I said, Will. And I said, I bet you any money they asked me about my tie. I went through all the interview. I didn't get the job because I was more airborne than ground. And the last thing the guy said to me, I was just going, he says, I'm interested about what tie is that you've got on? So I told him what it was, the sugar tie. And I walked out curling myself laughing. So to my wife, he asked me.
Were there any teething troubles with the Halley 2? Did you have any initial problems to sort out?
Not that I know of, yeah. Chris. Not that I know of. I can't think of any.
Did you ever get any strange results on your weather observations, your sonde recordings? It was all as expected.
Yeah, well, weather's unpredictable anyway. So it's... yeah, there's an odd few days. Halley, Wolf 1 went on fire once. And it was when one of the Met Men, I think it was Mac Kero, one of the chef's day. It was my day off. And he went driving it, and they come in and says, Keith, it's gone on fire. It's actually the valves had burnt on one side because of fire. So I had to repair. That was Woof 1. But the most things on Woof 1 that went was the drive shaft. Mm. It had to seize up. You had to keep greasing it. But that was the most things that ever went. That and the fire was the only maintenance problems I ever had. Mm. And Woof 2, in the year I ran it, I didn't have anything.
Sounds like you had a fairly smooth couple of years down there.
I did. I had a good smooth. It was every day. Every day in the morning. If it didn't work, you had to have another one. So sometimes it might have been 3 or 4 balloons.
Yeah.
But most days, it's by midday, you'd finish the Met Office. And then it was whatever went off on base that you had to do.
Mm. What was your nickname?
Mine? Mm. Little Ball of Evil.
The Ball of Evil?
Yeah, Chief or Little Ball of Evil. I was called Chief or Little Ball of Evil.
Where did that come from?
Well, it's a bit of a stirring job. It was Golly and Fanny used to call me the Little Ball of Evil, but others call me Chief. I don't know why they call me Chief. When Doc Murray, at Christmas, it was Doc Murray's birthday.
Right.
And we always thought Doc was a bit of a stirrer.
Yes.
So I got Golly to make him a wooden spoon with brown at the bottom for his birthday. Completely varnished, a nice wooden spoon, completely varnished with Happy Birthday, Doc, with the brown bit on the bottom, you see. So Golly told Doc Murray what he was doing. So they made me one as well. So when Doc got his, he gave me one back. And mine was got the Little Ball of Evil written on it. And that's why, because I'd done that, I was called the Little Ball of Evil by Doc.
They reckon you had a jokey personality?
Yes, I've always have. I was called Gags at school.
Right. Was that useful in the Antarctic, in a hut with a confined space with lots of men?
I don't know. I used to think that Bill Sloan had done a good job.
How do you mean?
Because we didn't have any problems with the people.
So the selection process?
Yeah. Because when I thought afterwards, that there's 20, 30 guys confined in for a year, because the boat, you were confined for a year together. Mm. And the little trouble that we had on base was unbelievable. There was a few skirmishes or arguments, but there was nothing major between people. And I thought, The selection process has been pretty good. I think I'd both the total 2 years, I can't remember any real bad incident between people, which was pretty good.
There's a story about a tin can, a beer, a drinks can. It doesn't quite scan here. Keith had to get up early for the Met skit, and I would hear a psst as he opened a can of Coke or lemonade. What a gentleman. He never drank it all.
That must be Golly.
Yes.
He had the bunk above me.
Was this a kind of antidote to the previous night's alcohol?
Or it was the first drink, because you're always thirsty.
Yeah.
Because I usually get up late. I didn't get up like I could have 2 cups of tea before I went on there.
Oh, right. Okay. You did all the wiring for the record player.
Yeah, in the new bass. I also repaired his tape recorder. And that was... He had a Grundig tape recorder. And there's a relay in it. It's made out of Paxilin. And I took the relay apart. And the 2 bits of Paxilin I glued. And I got it all back to working again. But I spent a lot of time... There was an old radio, 1937, Marconi. They used to have a plug-in wave change. It was plug-in. If you wanted to change the wave band...
Change the frequency.
The wave band. You had to unplug the cord and plug another set in. And somebody had played around with it. It wasn't working. In my spare time, I worked out the whole wiring diagram and re-soldered it all together and got it working. We used that. That was something to do.
So were you involved in wiring the bass then as well?
No.
That was done by contractors.
That was done by all the building guys, which had been Jeff Smith, was the electrician.
And also you were instrumental in helping to make sure that they kept in touch with field parties back at base. There was a radio communication system, radar contact.
That's the telerometers.
Oh, right. Oh, you use those?
Yes, you could speak. Yes, the telerometers not only just give you a radar beam, you actually had a telephone with it, so you could actually talk to each other.
Down the radar beam,
yes. So I repaired them. Well, I had to keep them in service.
Do you remember erecting a chicken wire fence on the caboose?
No.
Oh, right. Was that not part of the same process of keeping in touch with field parties?
Oh, Christ, yeah. That's because they wanted an aerial. Yes, as they were going, we're going to try and see whether the wind finder could pick them up. I'd forgotten all about that. Golly's caboose when he went on the Tottenham. I forgot all about that. Because not only that, yes, I put a little aluminium aerial on top of it as well. I'm pretty certain if I wrote my slides, I wouldn't have my slides, I've still got them. I've got the slides.
Right.
I'll have to look at
that. So it must be true.
I'll have to look at that.
Because
I think I also put a little aluminium tetrahedron thing on top to see if we could pick them up. Mm. To see if the wind, but it couldn't, because they were so low to the ground.
Right.
And the snow reflection, we couldn't pick them up. The radar wouldn't do it.
When you were coming to the point of leaving the Antarctic after your 2 years at Halley, what were your feelings? Were you glad to get out?
No.
You wanted to stay there?
Yeah, I could have done another year, same as John Carter and Jeff Smith.
Mm.
I felt I'd done, achieved something, and I felt that I, for my own benefit,
What did you achieve?
I don't know. I just felt that I'd done something I'd felt I'd wanted to do.
Mm.
And I felt good about it.
An achievement?
Yes, and I felt good about it. I was glad I'd been, and I could have gone, if I hadn't got married, my first wife, I used to tell her I'd like to go back again. But I didn't, because of families.
And what do you think, from those Antarctic years, do you think you took forward in your life that was useful to you, perhaps, when you were working in the...
Patience. A lot of patience. I come back with tons and tons of patience. Right? I did. You know, I still have. I've got loads of patience with everybody. Doesn't worry me what goes off.
And what about practical skills? Because you went to work, as you mentioned before, in the oil industry in desert areas.
None.
None?
No, because I came back to the Air Force.
Right.
When I came back into the Air Force. And the stuff on the Air Force was far more high-tech than what I'd been doing down there.
Were you behind?
No.
No?
No. I probably kept my hand in as well anyway, but I wasn't behind. See, the Air Force, you work on equipment and you've got the basic knowledge. Your apprenticeship is so good. Mm. The knowledge is there. If somebody got enough basic knowledge, they don't forget it.
Right.
And the basics have got to be drummed into people. And the Air Force apprenticeship drilled in your basics. And I still talk to people, you don't know the basics. That's why you're making mistakes.
But did the two Antarctic years were they useful to you later on as a good line on your CV, or were they just a complete diversion, deviation?
They never looked to be another job.
They didn't?
No. They were just something I'd done. Because I never took forward looking for a job based on the Antarctic. When I left the services, it was based on aeroplanes.
Right.
So my first 2 years after the services was working on military aircraft in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Teaching their Air Force.
Yes.
And then because of the electronics, then I went into the oil and gas on the electronic side. And then I worked in the oil and gas, and I still am working in the oil and gas since then.
And you were in Iran at the time of the revolution.
Whew. When I first came out of the Air Force, I went to Saudi Arabia for 2 years, working on the military aircraft. King Faisal was stabbed, assassinated at Dahran Airport, where we were. That was the king. I then went to Libya for 2 years, and we had the Libyan-Egyptian war erupt, and our vehicles were taken to war, because we were only 80 miles from the border, on the oil site, because we were in the oil and gas. And I went to Iran for the year on the oil and gas. That was the year of the revolution. So it came in threes. So I had a year in Iran, and then the revolution stopped that. Then I spent 8 years in Oman.
So of all those experiences then, Keith, which how high do the Antarctic years rate in that quite exciting life?
Very high.
Very high.
Oh, I think they were probably the best 2 years. As regards of me as a person, because I think it made me more patient in life, so that when I come and I've been working with lots of atrocious, badly managed and things with the oil and gas, that I've been able to just handle it as the patience. I haven't got mad at it or anything. I think it just gave me that.
You're going to need patience for editing the Bass Club magazine, which you're about to take over.
Yeah.
Do you have any plans?
None, actually, because until I got the last minutes for this AGM, I didn't realise that we were trying to make it all email.
Oh, right. No, I didn't. Yeah.
Right, yes. The proposal is that because of the expense of sending it out, they're proposing to make it all email, which then changes the things I was looking at printers and things. So I'd just have a talk to Bob, and then Bob's already handing things over, yeah.
Yeah.
And see how it goes.
Do you think the content will change? I mean,
no, I don't think the content will change. I think I have a few ideas to try to introduce things in. Again, it's come with talking to Bob last year and other people. Once I'd spoke to Bob and said I'd take it over, I got to thinking what could go in, and Bob says, yeah, we've got a lot more obituaries now, Keith, and that's the worst thing. He said, yeah, and he said, sometimes I have problems getting stories. He said, but I do get them. I'm looking for ideas all the time. So then I started thinking, I went home thinking, I made some notes of things that I thought we might introduce, but again, it's involving people, the fits. But I don't know if it's been done in the past yet, until I got all the information from Bob. I'd like to know. And again, he's talking over the dinners. Peter Clarkson was on about the results and the fossils he'd done from the mountains, Totten fellas, you see. And I said, I've done fossils. I've dug them out of the desert. I've cut geodes up and polished them because I used to do it. And I'm interested. Yeah, I've never knew you found fossils in the Totten fellas. So I wrote it down. I said, wouldn't it be a nice idea if we asked all a feedback of what happened on all these trips, into that, so that people like myself and the chefs and the people that didn't go in the field found out what did happen. So I've got that as an idea, and I don't know if that's been done before.
No, I don't think so.
So I thought maybe I might send out a thing and say anybody can tell us some feedback and just let us know in a short 1,000 words what happened to your results. Were they just archived, thrown away, or what? So that's another one I thought of. So I've been thinking over the year, since talking to Bob last year, you know, thinking about what how it can be to add into it. But I think the content's going to be the same. It's going to be stories, it's going to be Bass reviews and obituaries. Fortunately, you know, we can't get away with it. Eventually, 20 years' time, this might not be here. We might not have a Bass Club, because there's not... No young ones coming in that really interested in keeping it going, because they don't have that camaraderie. There's a few come, I know. But you need... There's 150 here. We need... You need another 150 from them, don't you?
So in what way have FIDs changed over the generations? What, compare a modern-day FID to your generation. How different are they?
When does an explorer an explorer? When there's something there that's not been seen before. When they go out exploring, with no thought of health and safety, right?
Yeah.
Doing it because it was, had to be done and took all the perils and all the risks. Mm. When did that stop? And that's what I keep in my head. If we look at what I did with Cozzy and what Dad with the Tottenham, what we did, shut on base for a year and did, then that might have been the end of the era. But once we start having people flying in for a month here, or 2 months there, that you can't call them explorers or FIDs. So well, there's a dividing line, and I don't know what it is. It's a grey line as where you could say, this is more true, but then look at, you go further back, and we were not Shackletons or Scots.
No, no, no.
We weren't them. They were more explorers than we were.
Well, maybe the dividing line is the introduction of the Dash 7.
The aircraft.
Mm.
That could fly into Halley.
Because suddenly you didn't have to winter anymore.
Yeah. I think that might be a good point.
And it's the wintering that bonded.
Yes, it's the winter that bonded.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
I'll leave you there with that thought. Thank you very much.
It's a good thought because we think about it. We talk about it.